And we are back May 1st, 2022. We had a faulty audio in the prior, so it was just cutting out too bad. So I had to change the approach. And we'll try it like this now. So now you had, as we were recapping, it would be some sort of heuristic approach that is bound to error to assume that there's some direct relationship between the Putin's meeting with the Secretary General of the UN and what we just saw right now. So we just, you know, there could be co-aligning plans operating in parallel, non-connected. There's multiple possible ways that multiple plans are being run, and only in the mind's eye, is us as the audience, as media consumers, do we like necessarily try to make some connection between, okay, this meeting happened and the press corps, both of these, you know, there was no agreement that was announced. So, I mean, there may have been some agreement of principles or something like that, but not like a plan of action. Parties may have agreed on a principle, or what they might have agreed on what an agreement would look like, but that doesn't mean that they had an agreement that led to action. They might have had an agreement that they don't, you know, that they don't agree to doing the same actions. To what extent Russia will allow the quote unquote UN, but at this time it goes in the direction of the so-called international community, sort of like the present orientation of the bureaucracy of this part of the UN around the Secretary General. And that is his job is to facilitate whatever sort of agreement that allows sort of like the NATO adjacent or all these different actors in the NATO orbit to try to extract or evacuate or whatever these guys, the trap soldiers, like the trap miners, we were saying, they're trapped. No, they refuse to surrender. Guys, come on. What is this? It's trapped. Like we said, it's like a natural disaster or something. They're trapped under snow. They were hiking and they got trapped before they cannibalize each other, like a Donner path. So obviously the role of the UN is going to have these kind of mixed, you know, it can lend some sort of brokered legitimacy to any agreement, but we don't know if what we're seeing right now is outgrowth of an agreement, the result of an inability to reach an agreement, something in between an agreement and not an agreement. Just reality happening all at the same time. And, you know, there's always category X that's possible. Sure. It's more prudent just to think of independent players carrying out what they think is the realm of the outward areas that they can punch. And wherever they feel they can, like, punch in whatever direction they think they can punch diplomatically or unilaterally, under the sort of fuzzy, unclear nature of a outcome of a meeting, or not outcome of a meeting, but a meeting did occur, and then suddenly these actions, right? Inferring to what degree the causal relationship is, speculative endeavor at best. But all right, just assuming that they're related or unrelated, it doesn't change what we saw in footage released so far. Did not indicate. I have to. I'm wanting to look at more footage that has emerged, but just speaking at this early hour on it and seeing the footage that I've seen so far, it looked like they were it was a Russian-controlled humanitarian zone, and the busing and stuff like that. I didn't see like UN. I didn't see any reporting that said that the UN was there, or that I don't think that the Russians allowed Ukrainians to come in. You see the issues that I'm struggling with in understanding this, right? In other words, what type of agreement would have the Secretary General agreed to? Except maybe there was some agreement or something, but it actually was just okay, just a sample number just to see how you would do the thing. And it's like 50 people, right? 46 people. Now, but it looked to me like all of them go through Russian custody, like a Russian step of custody. Like everything after that is kind of like whoever else is involved after the point of contact. Like when you're coming out of there, like do you see, French or just think about it. Like how would they use this to get foreign forces into the country, right? So it's potentially crazy. Now, maybe some of the people that came out are people close to the Azov people. Maybe it's like their immediate families, and they think they're trying to see if they're just gonna get them out. It's better than dying if they end up in whatever kind of, but they're hoping that they get to Zaporizhia. But the Russians said they brought them into Donetsk, right? We're just unclear. It could be two different buses. It's just, this is just very, very preliminary assessment of subject to change, right? It's a developing story. But remain open-minded about all the possible outcomes or who's working what dimension. We'll see right now. I mean, if the people that Azov is this people that Azov allowed to leave, or that the armed groups down there allowed to leave, or these people that what, how would they have known that there was this thing going on? Do they have access? I don't think they give them access to information unless these people do have access, and on what level of relationship that they have with the armed group down there. I'm just saying, how is that actually functioning down there, right? I mean, we don't know. Who would they have let out if they were the ones choosing? Would it have been like people that they liked the most, or would it have been maybe these valuable people, right? But that's kind of weird because it looked like they're going into Russian custody. So if it's a valuable people angle, would they let the valuable people out while he used to be alive? Was the agreement that they're gonna confer some diplomatic immunity to the or maybe promise to hold them, but pen charges and have more of a commitment to use them to trade pieces to barter with them. Maybe to swap people. I mean, I don't know, just in the future, just promise to hold them. I mean, there's just, you could create a myriad of possible outcomes, right? You don't have to decide that one is the only thing that's going to happen. It's a developing story. But a lot of things are possible and are within the realm of likelihood enough to mention, to list. That's what I always say, talking about what's going to happen. You always end up making a long list, so we just made one. Very interesting to see Kalina's Palomar, his comments about it. So that he's confirmed that he says 20 or something. See, there's a different, it's just unclear. It's unclear to me. Where this other number comes from, or why that's not mentioned, or maybe from the transmission from Kalina was from prior when the other group left. The second group, they say, left under as darkness fell. Well, I thought that was a very strange expression. It lends to possibilities of who came out in the second group. Is that more weird? Well, that have been people that that could be, this could have been the only release that they're aware of, or this might not be a group that they're aware of. We don't know which is which from the reporting, or that they acknowledge or happened prior. We just don't know. Maybe the other group comes from a different part of the plant or different part of the planet. Who knows? All kinds of things possible. And as we mentioned in the first part, the biggest thing now is going to be talking to these people. We'll get an idea of who they are and what happened if they get interviewed. If they want to talk to media and what they say. Did the Azov prepare a media group? And did the Russians prepare a media group? I don't know. But we'll see who gets interviewed and if we can piece together their story, how they got out. And maybe we'll see why there's two different listed groups of people. Just kind of see what the narratives look like. Maybe the Azov people themselves let out 20 something people, and they're all like prepared to say things that point one way. Maybe very sympathetic to the Azov group, or maybe very neutral to them, but also saying like, oh, here are all like these atrocities that the Russians committed on their way in through Mariupol. Maybe they'd be credible. Stories when you first heard them. I don't know. Maybe they wouldn't be. But you get the idea, So we'll see who's the Russian media that could cover it. It'd be like Russia One, Anna could cover it. I don't know if Life News is around anymore or not. I haven't seen them cover this. This could be covered a lot of different ways. So just look for different see what kind of stories come out. Well, we have two different types of stories. So we have one type of story, very interesting. Just in our list of potential outcomes, one of them would be if there was an agreement, it would have been to maybe the Palomar group agreed to release people that were like prepared to say things positive about Azov. And that's what the UN kind of was talking about. And they used the sort of and preliminary agreement on what the talk would be about to give kind of like the Azov people some sense of hope. And that would also get them thinking about on the, what their strategy is supposed to be to get people out that are going to say positive things about Azov, right? But if there were like another group of people from inside there that also had somehow contact, right? Maybe through a mirror, maybe through, who knows, from inside. Because remember, the Russians before said they already intercepted radio, right? Which means they could get in on the channel. Hello, hello. All right. So who knows who they're talking to or what's going on, but there may have been another group that also comes out, you see, using the, and Russia's guarding the whole thing, right? Until we see reports to the contrary. I mean, I'm curious to see. Oh, you know what? We have let me see here. Yeah, I was looking at the questions or comments or whatever the section was, and I saw our friend Patrick had something to say. So I thought it was very, very interesting. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that at all, if you can hear, but I've enabled your thing to speak. If you hear this and you want to pop on and just start wrapping with us what you were saying about a black pill scenario, that's very interesting. I think audience would greatly appreciate it. It's a, that's an interesting possibility, you know. I mean, there's a number of I'll save the space for you to talk about your idea. In the meanwhile, it's possible that Russians got out a group and the Azov people got out a group, and the Russians used the cover of darkness to get out more people. Who knows? And maybe the Russians like do a switch and they send the, people to different locations and agree to. And then control the media narrative. I don't know. I just one, one possibility out of numerous. But let us know what you think. Let me know what you think. So as I've been saying, it's just a developing story. It's just occurred in the, overnight. And looking at Al Jazeera, looking at the I shared the article from the Ukrainian news, like the kind of very pro Ukraine outlet, their version of it. I think it's important to look at the different, you can pull a lot of useful kind of like meta information or, broadly understand their paradigm through their use of language, any group, any people. Very useful. It's fascinating on the level of media analysis and messaging and their information war. So it's a very interesting kind of turn what has happened with this Azovstal development. It seems that any number, again, of things is possible. What has happened? We just won't know. It's all fog of war. There's always going to be a lot of illusion at play, and they could have agreed. They could have agreed that they don't agree, and they could have agreed not to say that they agree if they don't agree. I mean, talking about Putin and the UN. Many number of things you can agree to. You can agree not to give a discouraging public statement at the end of your non-agreement. You know what I mean? Why not? All these things are possible. But looking at the Al Jazeera, see Al Jazeera, I said I had been warning previously about to myself, warning myself, I should say, about how I wanted to remember my own dissatisfaction with Al Jazeera's coverage of the wars in, not the, 'cause they weren't around during the wars in Yugoslavia, but they kind of like produced these documentaries cover the commemorations and stuff like of a certain angle. And I think people, they don't know that it's the Al Thani dynasty doing Al Jazeera, and they just basically bought the assets or transferred the assets from the BBC. And the Al Thani dynasty comes in and picks it up. And because they covered things about the first occupation, like in 2003 period in Iraq, in a very fair way, I would say very fair way. And because they had covered Israel Palestine from a point of view that was sympathetic to Palestine, which is fair. I mean, it's everyone's prerogative. And because of that, they have a lot of legitimacy with parts of the left. And then there's a like the anti-imperialist left. And then there's a group within the left that takes a very, very similar posture, even though they're like these sort of Trotskyist or post-Trotskyist groups, like the ISO. And they kind of come in and make it seem like it's they kind of try to dominate the what's the how academics on the left should that want to be Marxist or something should approach the question. They try to have a lot large the Trotskyists try to have a lot of influence on that, of course. But there's a co-alignment in the things that these types of Trotskyist groups will that are also connected to the IS in the UK or what was it? used to be different groups like Socialist Workers Party and ISO. It's kind of different. Doing entryism and stuff like this, trying to take control of different local party sections of the Labor Party or whatever. But at any rate, Al Jazeera provides a very good window into sort of like how the left cover for imperialism or left, yeah, like left cover for imperialism or even left imperialism, but I would say it's left cover for imperialism is being operated by these kind of like neocons that still call themselves Trotskyists in a way, but these IS groups have like side campaigns that they establish as, like in the States, it's like 501c3s, and then they openly get like, they openly write to get grants from these Sorosian, you know, Open Societies Foundation type front. And get grants to operate these different campaigns, like run through these international socialist groups, like these Trotskyist kind of IS type groups. And that had is going to lead to very difficult and complicated coverage for journalists who are going to take fire from different factions of anti-imperialism when the conflict comes to the West Balkans. When the conflict comes to the Yeah, we have like a technical problem somehow. I don't know. Sorry for the interruption, folks. So there's an alignment in these positions, and Al Jazeera, you can see that in the Ukraine conflict, Al Jazeera is reporting things from they are reporting things from using the language of the pro-Ukrainian side in media. But and that's okay. I mean, it's just an objective, or you know, it's my subjective opinion of how I read the their use of language and their phrases. They're relying on Maxar technologies. They say so openly. And they're talking about that they report, it's a very interesting thing they do. They report from the perspective of they report from the perspective of the people there. From a video that was released. And then they use satellite images from Maxar, and then they show photos, then they talk to wives of Arseniy Theodosiuk and Denis Prokopenko of Azov. They talk to their wives, who are not there, I guess, okay? And they're saying that that the lives of soldiers matter too. Soldiers' lives matter. There's your, sorry, we took a while to get to it. We thought it would be worth just explaining how what's going on. Soldiers' lives matter. They urge that Ukrainian fighters also be evacuated alongside civilians. Warning, they could be tortured or executed if captured. Well, they could be sentenced to, they could be tried in a military tribunal and sentenced to death. The death penalty would apply in a military tribunal. And but why would they? I don't think the that's just true for the mercenaries, but the Nazi guys are actually in the army of Ukraine and are necessarily treated as POWs. So I don't think it's accurate that they could be afforded all of the rights, however, under the Geneva Convention, but just through processing them and the military justice system in the forensics of the battlefield stuff, and witness testimony, you know, maybe, or evaluation of their electronic devices as well and their own photo collections, determine if these guys who have been involved in killings or are, you know, war criminals, and maybe they would keep them and try them, and maybe they wouldn't trade them. Maybe this is going to be part of a very big thing of the great trials that will have to occur, right? Because you have Nazis, you need to, whenever you finish off Nazis, you need to have like really big trials about all the war crimes and the atrocities and stuff. I think that's like a rule. I mean, you know what I mean by that. Not like a written rule, but it would be foolish, is what I mean, is it would be foolish to not handle it that way. And we've seen it referenced already numerous times in Russian media, that they would be having these trials. I think official statements have been made to that extent as well. Yes, certain of it now. Okay, I'm just going to look at a few of the questions. Well, I think I'm turning the page just to look at, I might just do this question just with Poland, because the Poland thing is big right now also. So I think Poland is a useful thing to talk about. Okay. Yeah, they're having military drills. We'll see what they do. I don't know. Russia kind of leaked this plan out there. You could see that the ultra nationalists and Nazis in Ukraine are not totally happy with that kind of proposition, that kind of proposal. They're not happy with it. And in the media sphere. It was, you know, in the papers and the predictable back and forth, just in Ukrainian, on Ukrainian internet and like Ukrainian radical politics thing, kind of always gets this conversation going again, or this argument between groups of Poles and what are called Ukrainians now, but it's like this kind of Galician thing, kind of superimposed on the whole of Ukraine in some way. Very strange. So Poland could be whatever they do or haven't ruled out doing, or you know, you just don't know until a country does something, right? You just don't know. If Ukraine invites them in, is the only way that they could come in. And maybe all that is floated as a way to keep Russia from striking that area, because the more and that Russia strikes that area, the more, that's like the equation that I have in my head. The more that Russia strikes that area, the more it's going to make the argument kind of sound nice, better to have Poles come in. Because maybe the thinking is that somehow that would discourage Russian strikes. What do you think? So there's a lot of ways of looking at all of that. I mean, there's no particular, I don't have any insider information, right? How to evaluate that. Clearly, Poland, it would be a very radical thing for them to occupy within, to be a country. You kind of to do that, such as Poland, given its relationship with the West in Western institutions, I mean, all of them, right? Poland's in all of the all of them. And if it were to do a thing, kind of maybe view parallel to what Russia's doing in Ukraine, Poland were to kind of mirror that, it would be a big flex on the part of Poland for sure, as we said. So, coming full circle then, we're not, there's, those are the big things that are moving in information areas that are peripheral to the actual conflict part of military, heavy military activities in the Donbas. So that's very interesting, just as a segue to think about it. in those terms. Like, neither the Azovstal thing is kind of in a area of a settled, you know, conflict that's done. Mariupol is done. The whole area there is done, you know. But in terms of this diplomatic aspect and, you know, who's there and how to release them, like, that's it's an ongoing drama. But for the amount of time that it prolonged, like, imagine, like, it's like football. Like American football, every time there's a down, kind of like you can reconnoiter. And imagine, like, the refereeing that's happening. It was like the fighting, and then the stop of focus on fighting. Fighting continues. Stop of focus on fighting. Get some official announcements out. But once the Azovstal thing is resolved, I think only then. Will you see Russia again in a position where they're willing to take another, you know, big media risk of similar scale? I don't know if they would want to manage two at the same time. Can they fight that kind of information war on two fronts? It's hard to say. So I think it's prudent for them to wrap it up anyway with Azovstal and what's going on there. So, yes, just all things to consider, all the different reasons they could give, all the objectives that it might serve, and where the two different groups might have come from, why it was written about that way. I mean, you know, and potentially why it happened that way is very, very interesting. So be on the lookout for that. If it, you know, just wrapping up then today. So got to give it the 48-hour rule. See what comes up in the behind the scenes stuff, what kind of interviews happen from the people that were down there, and then you'll kind of know what how this was played. All right, it's been good talking to you today. This is gonna be saved, and this is like the longer of the two parts from today talking about that development. All right, we're out.